And I've titled this message taken from Psalm 37. You have your Bible, you want to turn to Psalm 37, that'd be a good thing to do. I just want to consider the first nine verses during our time together this afternoon. But I've titled this message, Between Two Worlds. Is there a book by that title, Between Two Worlds? There might be. But anyway, that's not what I have in mind. What I have in mind, you'll find out in a moment what that title really means. But you know, some Bible teachers have, I think, oversimplified it, and they have said this, that the Jewish people are an earthly people and that the church is a heavenly people. I understand what they mean by that. What they mean is when you read the Old Testament, you'll find that the majority of the promises given to the Jewish people have to do with the earth, like the land of Israel that is promised to them, the kingdom, which is a literal physical kingdom that is promised to them. So, however, the psalm actually refers to that being true of the Jewish people. The psalm, of course, is the songbook that the Jewish people used. And I want you to note some of the references to this earth in Psalm 37 real quick. Look at verse 9. They shall inherit the earth. Look at verse 11. The meek shall inherit the earth. Look at verse 22. The blessed shall inherit the earth. Verse 29. The righteous shall inherit the land, meaning, of course, the land of Israel, the righteous being believing Jewish people. Verse 34. He shall exalt thee to inherit the land. And so there's many references in this 37th Psalm alone that refer to the Jewish people in the future kingdom period inheriting that land and that portion that God promised to them way, way back in their scriptures. In fact, that's exactly what Jesus meant when he said in what we call the Beatitudes in Matthew 5 and verse 5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. He's speaking to Jewish people in that passage, and he is referring to that earthly inheritance that they will have one day. And you might say that as a result, the nation of Israel is stuck between two worlds. The one that they're in or were in, and the one that is yet to come when they will realize the fulfillment of those land promises. They don't yet possess that promised portion, but they're always looking forward to the reality of it. Well, let me say this. Not only the Jewish people. Are you with me? All human beings, all human creatures are created to be earth dwellers. That's what the Bible says, that is our realm. That's our dwelling. We're earth dwellers. And when you see how it all ends in the book of Revelation, you know what you find? When it's all said and done, the final phase of human life, all human life, that survives and dwells with God will live in a city called the New Jerusalem on a place called the New Earth. And it's simply the old earth that has been rejuvenated and has been renovated. And so, in a sense then, all human beings are earth dwellers. And you could say this, that believers are stuck between two worlds. In fact, Jesus, in his great prayer, the Lord's Prayer in John 17, I think it's verses 14 and 15. He says something to this effect. Father, they're in this world, but the world hates them. They're not of this world. But he doesn't say, Father, thus take them out of the world. He says, they're in this world. They're not of it. Keep them from the evil. Keep them from the evil one. That's Jesus's prayer. So, if you're a believer, you honestly should be looking forward to a coming new world. You should always have your eyes on a future promised coming new world. And thus, whenever we're frustrated with our current circumstances, it's because we forget that we're part of a new world that's on its way. Hasn't come yet, but it's on its way. And when we're frustrated with the current conditions, it's because we have lost sight of the fact we are part of a new world. We're a new race, you might say, a new human race that is going to inhabit a coming new world. When you lose that focus that, as the spiritual says, this world's not my home, I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. But you know, that somewhere beyond the blue is going to be one day, as I said a moment ago, on a new earth. Because we're earth dwellers. That's what God made us to be. I'm part, and if you're a believer, you're part of a new world that's on its way, that's coming. Just like ancient Israel, we tend to be upset over evil conditions. You know what it's all about? Your focus. It is all about your focus. You'll get disillusioned. You'll get discouraged. You'll get depressed if you're merely focused on the present. It all comes down to what you're focused on. If your main focus is the present life, this present life, current conditions, you're going to be depressed. You're at least going to be discouraged. So, turn to Psalm 37, and I want to look at some verses with you. We'll start with the first two. Notice it. Fret not thyself because of evildoers, that is, deviants, people that deviate from what God says is right. Fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity, because sometimes it seems like they're better off than we are, right? Verse 2, here's why. For they shall soon be cut down like the grass, and wither as the green herb. Three times in the first nine verses of Psalm 37, believers are told, stop fretting. Don't fret. See it? It's there in verse 1. It's repeated again in verse 7. Fret not thyself. It's repeated again in verse 8. Fret not thyself. Verse 1, fret not thyself. We don't use that word fret very much. You know what the Hebrew word that is translated fret really means? It speaks of heat. It speaks of something that's burning, something that's blazing. And so to fret is to burn. To fret is to seethe with anger. To fret, in fact, he uses the word anger in verse 8. See that? Cease from anger. And the Hebrew word translated in English, anger, is a word for the nose or for the nostrils. And perhaps it has to do with the fact that when you're really mad, sometimes your nostrils flare, right? Yeah. And then he uses the word wrath also in the the eighth verse, cease from anger and forsake wrath. So fret and anger and wrath, which wrath is a fever. It's being feverish. And it's talking about emotional fever. It's talking about anger. And so when he says three times, fret not, if fret means heat, he's saying, cool down. Cool down. Cool down about your situation. Cool down about politicians and politics. Cool down over the injustices and the inequities between criminals and victims. Cool down over the fact that people seem to be getting away with evil and innocent people are being punished instead. Cool down because wicked people seem to possess some temporary advantage. He says it in verse 2, they may, but it's going to be short-lived. They may have an advantage over us temporarily, but it's not going to last. You got to believe God on that. But on the other hand, over and over again in this 37th Psalm, he stresses the fact that while evildoers, while wicked people, while deviants may seem to be prospering currently, presently, it's short-lived, it's only temporary. However, believers that are following God's way, they are promised permanent blessing, not temporary, permanent blessing. You know why we fret? You know why we fret over situations and current conditions? Because we're focused on the temporal and we are forgetting about the more important eternal. Simple fact. You will fret when you focus on the temporal and you overlook the important, more important eternal. That's why we should stop fretting, according to these verses, is because, hey, the conditions that we're in might seem like they're going on and on and on and on. Nothing's changed. They're temporary. They're temporary. God's blessings are permanent. That's why you should stop burning. That's why you should cool down. Now, the rest of the time that we have here in these first nine verses, he shows us how we can stop fretting. Okay? We just looked at why we do. Now he shows us how we can stop. And it really goes along with what I was preaching on this morning in Daniel chapter 11. And that is simply this. God is in sovereign control of the governments of this earth. Doesn't look that way, does it? Doesn't seem that way. But the fact of the matter is, it's true. In fact, not only is God in control of world events, geopolitical events, and world history, but the Bible teaches us that God is the one that has set the limits on the rise and fall of nations. Now, this is just a sidebar. It really doesn't have anything to do with Psalm 37, but I feel like I should say this. You can study the Old and New Testament prophecies and you'll never find any reference to the United States of America. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because there are Bible teachers that have tried to find the United States in prophecy. It's not there. It's not there. Why isn't it there? We're so important, aren't we? We're like a flash in the pan when it comes to all of world history. Why is not the United States in Bible prophecy when other nations are? You know, Iran is, Germany is, Russia is. Yeah, we could go down a list of nations that are specifically mentioned in Bible prophecy, but not the United States of America, which makes me wonder whether there will be a United States of America in the future, that it may just be consumed and it might just be part of what is, what we see the Antichrist calls a one world government. We'll get sucked into that. I don't know if we even exist at that point. Who knows? But that's a sidebar. The point is that God is in sovereign control of government. And that doesn't mean that he approves of all the evil that government does. But even when government is out of control, out of human control, God's in control. Even though it's being manipulated by these unseen evil spirits that Daniel 10 talks about and Ephesians 6 talks about, the rulers of the darkness of this world, God ultimately is in control. And we know how it's going to end because he's told us in the Bible. And so get that big picture in mind, that God is in control of world history and world governments, and that he has set the limits of the rise and fall of nations. And as a result, give God time and trust him. All you need to do is give God time and give him your trust. It'll work. How to stop fretting? Well, look at verse 3. First point. How can you stop burning? How can you cool down about your current situation or current conditions? Number one, trust in the Lord. Trust, that sounds simple, doesn't it? Trust in the Lord. To trust in the Lord is literally to be without care. You know, we talk about people being careless and in a negative sense, you know, oh, he's not careful, he's careless. Well, might be. But believers are to be careless concerning circumstances. They're not supposed to allow circumstances to get them down. We're to be without care. We're to be free from anxiety because we're depending on the promise and the power of a loving Abba, a loving Father. And so we don't have to worry about, you know, if you grew up in the home that I grew up in, or if some of your homes where you had a loving, caring father, you didn't have to worry about where your next meal was coming from. You didn't have to worry about whether you would have proper clothing to wear outside. You didn't have any worries at all. Why? Because you knew your dad was going to take good care of you. You realize that the Bible is the only book that calls God a father. He's our heavenly father. He is our Abba. And you can trust him just as if you have a good earthly father, you can trust him for your well-being, for your welfare. You can trust Abba. He's promised it in his word, the Bible, and he has the power to carry out what he's promised, to make it happen. And so you don't have to run when the heat gets turned up. You know, we have people fleeing New York City because the crime rate is rising. I get that. You know, it's going to rise everywhere eventually. It might be good in Florida right now, but there's coming a day when it's not going to be good in Florida either. You can't run from your problems. You can't run out of fear. Fret not. You got to be where you are certain God puts you. Look, if I wasn't certain that God put me in New York City, number one, I would have never come here. Number two, I would have never stayed here. I've been here over 26 years now because God put me here and he's going to keep me here until he says, now I want you somewhere else. Ruth, that book, is about a family that when things got hot, when conditions went south, when things got bad, they ran from their problems. And when they ran from their problems, they created greater problems for themselves. And that's what happens. I was saying today, people believe that saying, the grass is greener on the other side. But they forget it also needs to be mowed. There's always responsibilities. There's different kind of problems. So Elimelech and Naomi and their two boys, they ran from Israel. They ran from Bethlehem when that famine, when that drought struck, and they didn't know where their food was going to. They went where they could find food. They went to the land of Moab. And what problems they created for themselves. Trust in the Lord. That's the point here in verse 3. That's the first step when it comes to dealing with that burning, to cool down and not fret about evil. Second thing in that third verse, do good. See that? Trust in the Lord and then do good. I say that means refocus. Refocus. Stop looking at yourself and pitying yourself because of the situation that you're in. And start looking with interest in others to help with whatever needs they might have that you can meet. Stop being self-focused. Start focusing on others around you that need the Lord or need help in some way or another. This is God's remedy to not fret. Trust in the Lord, do good. We have a sister that has a need for some meal help, right? Well, do good. Stop focusing on your pitiable conditions and do good. And if it's in your power to do so, then have a part in that, in helping. Otherwise, you'll be focused on yourself, and that's a death wish. Whenever we're self-focused, that's so detrimental. You're going to be just caught up in fretting. The third thing is in verse 4. There's five of them, by the way. So we're more than halfway through here. In verse 4, delight thyself also in the Lord. And he'll give thee the desires of thy heart. So trust in the Lord. Here, delight thyself in the Lord. That is, the word delight has to do with delicacies, like food that is a delicacy. Maybe to some people, it's caviar. Not to me. But maybe there's a delicacy food that you can think of, a luxury item. That's what the word delight derives from. In other words, seek for the delicacies, the luxuries that are found in the Lord, that are found in a close, intimate relationship with God. Seek those delicacies. Seek those luxuries in life. Not how you can bring comfort to your body, but rather how you can bring delicacies and luxuries to your soul, to that inner man. Delight yourself in a close, intimate relationship with the Lord. Desire to know God is what he's saying. You want to stop fretting? Turn your attention off of yourself onto others. Focus on God too. Focus on a desire to know God. And he says, if you do that, God will fully satisfy every longing of your heart and life. What are you longing for? What do you want most out of life? Did you know that if you seek the Lord, that the desires of your life will be fully satisfied by him when you come into an intimate relationship with him? Do you have that? You know, you might even be a believer, but you're seeking for whatever you can get out of life. I don't know what it is. It might be things. It might be money. It might be a position. It might be, you know, a relationship, whatever. You seek that, you'll never be satisfied. You'll always need more. But he says, if you will seek for the delicacies and luxuries found in a close, intimate relationship with the Lord, when you desire to know God, you're going to find out he fully satisfies your desires. He doesn't say that. Now, don't misread that second part of the verse 4. He'll give thee the desires of thine heart. Don't think that that's a promise that if you'll seek God, you'll have more things in life. That's not a promise for prosperity gospel. That's not a promise for more things in life. It's a promise of more God in your life. And that's what we need. More of God in our life. When we desire things in life, you know what happens? We become envious of others that have more than we do. We feel deprived. And when we begin to question, when we feel deprived or envious of others, we begin to question, what's the value of living a Christian life? Why be a Christian? These guys, they're not Christians. Look at what they have. Look at how happy they are. And you begin to question the value of living a Christian life, because when you live for anything other than a relationship that's intimate and close with God, your attitude is a give me attitude. What's in it for me? What's in it for me? What do I get out of it? That is a wrong attitude for a believer to have, for sure. Okay, number 4. How can we not fret? How can we cool down and stop the burn? Number 1, trust in the Lord. Number 2, do good. Number 3, delight in the Lord. Number 4, look at verse 5. Commit thy way unto the Lord, and he'll act. He'll bring it to pass. Commit thy way unto the Lord. That word commit is an interesting word picture. Everyone nowadays, even the littlest guys, seem to be wanting a backpack. Everyone wants a backpack. It's a cool thing to have a backpack, if you haven't figured that out yet. You got to have a backpack if you're going to be cool. Even the little ones, they want their backpack. It makes them feel so important. Well, you know what? This commit is the picture of taking that backpack that is just heavy and rolling it off of you. And he says, commit your way to the Lord, rolling it off and rolling it on the Lord. That's what the word commit pictures. It's rolling your way on the Lord, casting all of your burden and your opportunity upon God. In other words, it's putting God in total charge of your life. To give God complete control of, commit thy way, is to give God complete control. Stop trying to run your life. Stop trying to make this, that, and the other happen. Put God in charge of your life. Surrender it all to God. And you know what? He'll bring it to pass. He'll use you his way. He'll make it happen. He'll call the shots and you'll be happy at the results. Commit thy way unto the Lord. You know, all worried about economics, all worried about this inflation and this that's going south and this that's seeming ruined, and we're going to lose the American dream. Commit thy way to the Lord. And then the fifth and final thing is found in verse 7. Rest in the Lord. Okay? Trust in the Lord. Delight thyself in the Lord. Commit thy way to the Lord. Here, rest in the Lord. What does it mean to rest in the Lord? Does it mean that you're just a passive robot? Asleep? Mind numb? No. To rest in the Lord means to not be upset at what's going on, at what he allows into your realm. To rest in the Lord means that you are patiently waiting. The word rest means to be silent and to be still. to be silent and still, to be patiently waiting silently still. Because remember, you've committed, you rolled your way onto the Lord. You've committed to him. So you don't have a worry now. You're waiting for him to work. You're waiting for him to act. You're waiting for his direction. You're waiting for him to bring it to fruition. And so as a result, when you rest in the Lord, you're patiently, silently, still, you're experiencing God's peace because you believe that regardless of what it looks like, God's at work. You might not see anything happening, but you believe that God's at work. That's what it means to rest in the Lord. You believe that God is at work and that he's a God that is good. His goodness and his justice are such that if he's at work, then you can trust him. It's going to work out. God's at work. You, when you rest, you believe God's at work. And you believe that God is at work for you. That you believe that God is at work on your behalf in a good and just way. And you believe that God is at work in you. That is, deep within your soul, he's working. And you believe that God is at work through you. That is, he is making a difference in the lives of other people whose lives you touched. That he's working through you. They may not ever say it. They may not ever say, you know what? Something you said to me, that phone call, that text, that email you sent me, whatever you did, that they may not ever say, thank you for that. You know what? That really helped me. That really touched my life. But you believe it by faith. You're resting in the Lord. Look, there's not a whole lot of pats on the back when it comes to serving the Lord. It's just the way it is. But there's coming a day when Jesus himself is going to pat the servant on the Lord that has learned to trust in him, to do good, to delight, and to commit and rest in him. And he's going to say, well done, good and faithful servant. And then it'll be worth it all, like we say. It will be worth it all when we see Jesus, when that happens, when that takes place. You know what the bottom line of this Psalm 37 is? The first one, trust in the Lord. That's what the New Testament calls walking by faith. Trusting in the Lord is walking by faith. And that is what Jesus was trying to illustrate when he said, I am the true vine and you are the branches connected to the true vine. What he was trying to picture there for us in John 15 is a life that trusts in the Lord, a life that does good, a life that delights in the Lord, a life that commits their way to the Lord, and a life that rests in the Lord. That John 15 picture that Jesus used is the abiding life. And the a life that abides in him is a life that depends upon Jesus to do what he says he will do and to do for you what you can't do for yourself. Commit thy way unto the Lord. Jesus says it in John 15, I think it's verse 5. He says, for without me you can do nothing. But he can do for us what we can't do ourselves or for ourselves. So it's all about your focus. Getting back to that. It's all about your focus. The writer of Hebrews says that we are to, he calls the Christian life in that passage, not a walking by faith, but running, he says, with endurance. Because the Christian life isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. And so you need endurance to finish a marathon. So he says, run with endurance the race that is set before you, looking unto Jesus. That's your focus. That's your focus. It's all about your focus, and your focus has to be on him. It has to be Jesus. We're stuck between two worlds. We're part of a new world that's coming. sooner than later. But we have to focus on the one who established it and who will make it happen, looking unto Jesus. And he says, and I would say this, all of these five things in verses 3 through 7, those five things, how not to fret, how to put the fire out, how to not burn, how not to be angry and frustrated and upset. Those five things, every single one of them are a personal choice that you make. I can't make it for you. It's a personal choice that you as an individual makes. And when you make that personal choice, what you do is you exchange these for fretting. You exchange fretting for trusting in the Lord. You exchange fretting for delighting in the Lord. You exchange fretting for doing good. You exchange fretting for committing your way to the Lord. You exchange fretting for resting in the Lord. It's the exchanged life. Instead of being angry and upset at yourself and everyone else around you, make the exchange. It's a personal choice. If you don't choose it, it's not going to happen. You got to choose to make this exchange. And rather than burning with fretting, you can be filled with the fire of God in your soul. God's fire. And that's a good thing. That's a good way to burn. There's a song that says, "Let me burn out for you, O Lord. Let me burn out for you." That's the right kind of burning. And I hope that today you'll take these things to heart and that it will make a difference in the way that you view the world that you and I live in and the circumstances that we don't even anticipate are going to happen before this day is over and tomorrow when we wake up. We don't know what a day is going to bring forth, but we know how to not fret. It's simple. Personal choice to make this kind of an exchange. Otherwise, you're going to be one angry, bitter person. The older you get, the more deeper that bitterness goes and the more bitter you become through the years. I don't want to die a bitter old man. And you don't want to die a bitter old woman or a bitter old man either. And this is the key. You have to make this personal choice and make this important exchange. Right? Any questions? I think I have a couple of minutes before we're done. Yeah.
Mother?
Yeah.
When I was home with surgery on my hip, I was spiritually in a semi-coma. I didn't care about how to serve.
Yeah.
I didn't ask the Lord, make me serve even though I'm like this.
Yep.
And I regret that recuperation time with all my heart.
Well, I'm telling you, you grew through this, though. You know? These are not wasted time. When we blow it, they don't have to be wasted times. We learn through these things. And that's a glorious thing. God uses even our failures to turn us around and to strengthen us. And so, you know, and I'm not saying this to single Liz out, but I'm telling you, my heart was encouraged by the fact that she had all of her belongings stolen from her a couple of weeks ago. And she's thanking God anyway, even though it was it's been a headache and difficult for her. She's been thanking God. That's a testimony to me. That's an example and an encouragement to my heart. And that's a victory. When you praise God in, you know, bad circumstances, you honestly, sincerely thank God for it. That's a victory. And that's an encouragement to God's people as well. And it gives honor to the Lord. Anyone else? Okay. You get it then? You going to make the choice? Make the exchange?